Hey there, Dragonfly Nation. Caleb coming to you with a really cool offer from my dear friend Chris Gilmore from Chris Outdoors. When you first get started exploring the outdoors, whether it be through hunting, camping, or survival skills, it can all get a little bit daunting and maybe even overwhelming in regards to how much there is to learn. Having a solid foundation in tracking and naturalist skills can help open the door to bushcraft and make you learn much faster. It can also just make things outdoors that much more fun and exciting. What bird made that call? What animal does that track belong to? What do those clouds mean in regards to the incoming weather? Nature awareness is a skill set that is transferable to all aspects of bushcraft and beyond. Whether you are a hunter, a trapper, an angler, a survivalist, a paddler, or a hiker, this skill set can help make you safer and make your experiences that much more enjoyable. Chris has taught literally thousands of people how to read sign, whether it be through tracks, bird language, or the environment itself. And with his new online learning course, Reading Nature's Language, he can help you take your skills to the next level. Even though it is based online, you will have access to tons of practical activities and challenges that will make you the woodland Jedi you always wanted to be. Check out the trailer and more details at www.learnnatureslanguage.com. And just to sweeten the deal for you, enter the promo code DRAGONFLY to get 25% off the course. Again, that is www.learnnatureslanguage.com with the promo code DRAGONFLY for 25% off.
To know the landscape is to open up a door. Deeper connected than you've ever felt before. We know that you will love this podcast. So shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hello, Dragonfly Nation. This is our February bonus episode, voted on by our patrons. And this episode is all about seed saving. Throughout the whole season, we are growing crops. We're growing food, whether it be corn, beans, squash, tomatoes, pears, apples, whatever it may be. And all through that time, we have to prepare ourselves to take care of those crops for the next year. And one of the first things we have to do is save those seeds. And so in this episode, we're going to break down how I save seeds and understand what seed saving really is all about. So what is seed saving and why should we save seeds? So seed saving is a pretty straightforward title for what we're trying to do. We are trying to take the seeds from the crops or the plants we grew the year before, and we're trying to pick the best seeds out of all of them, and we're going to preserve those for the next growing season. So the best corn, the best tomatoes, the best calendula flower, the best nasturtium, whatever it may be that we're growing, we want to save those seeds for the next growing season. And why do we do this? Why would we save seeds? When it comes down to heirlooms, there's a lot of reasons to save seeds. First off, it's going to save you money, as in you can buy the seeds one time and only once if you're lucky. And then from the rest of your career of growing that crop, you just repeat the process again and again and again by saving some of its seeds. Another benefit of saving seeds is it preserves specific attributes of the plants from your specific region. So seeds that are from locally grown plants have better success in your region than seeds from the same plants but grown elsewhere. So the first year I grew flint corn, basically calico, Bear Island calico flint corn, the first year the seeds weren't that great. The corn wasn't that great. The crop wasn't that great. Maybe got 5 feet tall, maybe. And it wasn't very viable. The seeds, like the cobs, were very, you know, sparse and kind of weak. But I took the best kernels out of those, and I took the best cobs of that whole batch, and I saved those for seed for the next year. And I did it again. And sure enough, the next year, you know, 6-7 feet tall, and the kernels were a little bit more plentiful in the cob. And by the third season, they were 15 feet tall and full cob stalks. Like the kernels completely covered the entire cob. And that specific strain is now acclimatized or acclimated to my region. Whereas if I start from scratch again, I'm going to have to start off, pardon me, with the exact same struggle. Very sparse kernels on the cob, very short stalks, not that very viable. They're not doing great. and I want to fight and fight and fight to get it to be to the point that it actually succeeds. So that's a huge benefit to me to see, to save seeds, is it'll make it stronger in my region. It also helps keep rare seeds viable and varied in regions. So if I go to a seed saving or a seed exchange, a seed saving group or a seed exchange, and they have Seneca Pink Lady Flint corn, and I have Seneca Pink Lady Flint corn, we can trade seed, and now their Seneca Pink Lady Flint corn that they grow will have some of mine mixed in with it. And that's going to give it more variety, which is going to give it better success later down the road, and vice versa. And with that, the final real benefit of seed saving is I now have goods to take to seed sharing events, whether it be seed sharing initiatives or intertribal food summits or any kind of food summit. Or anywhere else that I could potentially share my seeds, share my corn, my beans, my squash, my tomatoes, my calendula, whatever it may be. I now have something that I could take with me to trade or exchange and get cooler crops to bring back to my garden. So there's a lot of benefits to it. There's a lot of benefits to it. So now that we understand why seed saving is beneficial and why it's a good idea, let's go into how we can start to take an approach to this. Although we're talking about this here in the winter time, seed saving really starts once you've planted the garden. Once you've planted your crops, whatever it may be, whether it's herbs or it is large fruiting bodies like squashes, or of course your fruiting trees, or if it's just simply grains and such, or your cereal grains such as corn, or your pseudo cereals such as amaranth or Wasantle, which is one of my favorites, which is the red amaranth, which some people call Aztec spinach and a bunch of other names. It's actually closely related to our lamb's quarter, which is a native and non-native weed that you find quite often in the garden, ironically right beside the Wasantle. Whatever the plant is, you're going to want to start observing your plants. You're going to want to start looking at the ones that are doing the best, the ones that are succeeding the most, and mark them. Mark them down with a piece of flagging tape, or put a stake beside that one and mark it like save, and just write save on magic marker on the stake. Or just make it so that if you see that stake by the plant, you know that's the plant you want to gather. And start keeping an eye on those ones. Not necessarily nurture them more than the rest, because honestly, earlier in the season this year, I thought I knew exactly which corn stalks I was going to be saving seed from. And I was completely surprised at the end of the season. It was a completely different plant. But this is where we start to learn, start observing the ones that are going to have the largest volume of seed, have the best success stories, all that kind of stuff. You're watching them carefully. You're observing them throughout the growing season. And yes, you're going to water them. Yes, you're going to give them more nourishment. But that's the same with all of your plants. You shouldn't start, you know, neglecting your other crops just because you found your seed-saving plant at the beginning of the season. So nourish them all, take care of them all, observe them all, because again, it can switch up. Sometimes you can have a catastrophe where a windstorm comes in or heavy frost comes in midsummer or something like that comes along and damages what you thought was going to be your seed saver plant. And it turns out you're going to have to go with another one, or something starts to really weaken that one. And suddenly your other ones start to vibe much better and they start to become more vibrant. They start to become stronger. They start becoming more healthy. And sometimes it's a slow start like that. Just begin at the beginning and watch them, observe them. Once you plant them, keep an eye on every single plant you grow, every single one of them. Observe them, nourish them, and take journals, noting in a journal what the plants are doing and how they're acting helps you in a lot of things, more than just seed saving. But in general, your holistic approach to gardening. Got a bit of a cough tonight. I was by a fire for the last 4 days, so my lungs haven't really fully recovered. But yeah, very smoky fire for very long periods of time, almost 96 hours straight. Anyways, with that being said, we're going to look at our plants and we're going to observe them and study them, and we're going to keep an eye on them. Once they start getting ready to go to flower, when they start to get their blossoms ready, we need to take into consideration a few things. First and foremost, we have to consider cross-pollination. A lot of people will plant a lot of different varieties of one species in their garden. they want to put in, you know, yeah, it's nice to have cherry tomatoes, but they're going to want to have two or three types of cherry tomatoes. And yeah, they're going to want to have some plum tomatoes or maybe even some big like beefeater tomatoes, but they're going to want more than one strain. Or maybe they're going to want peppers and you're going to want, you know, some jalapenos. You're going to want to have some Fresnos and a bunch of other types of peppers. That's all well and good. The problem is when these things begin to pollinate, you can get what's called cross-pollination. And for a lot of people, cross-pollination is not a big deal in their garden. They're not really too concerned about it. But there's some of us who are really focused on preserving heirloom varieties of crops. And those heirloom crops or heirloom flowers or whatever they may be, those heirloom plants, cross-pollinating changes what that plant is no longer that heirloom variety. A great example for this, I'm going to keep going back to, is corn. So we grow in my backyard calico flint corn from Bear Island, which is an Anishinaabe community. And that corn is very specific. It has very specific color patterns. It has very specific growth heights and nutrient densities and all these other things that make that corn very specific. The minute I let it grow near a cornfield full of Monsanto variety, you know, peaches and cream sweet corn, or beside dent corn, or beside what some people dent or cow corn, whatever it may be, these are wind pollinating plants. And so the tassels are the flowers of my corn or of all corn. And as the wind billows around, it's going to toss that pollen around in the air. And it's going to pollinate that Monsanto crop, and it's going to pollinate my crop with Monsanto pollen. And sure enough, when I start looking at my corn, if I'm not careful, if I don't plant it in the right spots, I'm going to find more yellow forms showing up in my cobs. And so my corn is usually closer to blue and black and a little bit of dark burgundy red, a little bit of white, a little bit of pink, and a little bit of almost yellow, but not directly yellow. And that's almost like an orange more than yellow. It's like a ruddy, orange. Definitely not yellow corn. And that's that calico pattern we're looking for in calico flint corn. But if I start seeing yellow show up, that's a warning sign. That's a big warning sign that there's something wrong. And that's a problem of cross-pollination. Now my corn is going to act more like those sweet corns. And if I plant those seeds from those cobs in the ground, next year's growth is going to be different. Add the fact that Monsanto has trained their corn through genetic modification, genetic engineering, to not be viable seed for the next year. It's not a sustainable seed crop. And so this could actually interfere my corn and being able to produce viable seed for next year. So what's the first thing I can do? Well, I need to completely isolate my corn from any of those kinds of crop fields. Luckily, where I live, there is no one nearby me that is growing corn within about 2.5 kilometers of me that is growing any type of corn. I am safe from corn pollen in that light. But if it's my neighbor, what if my neighbor wants to grow corn? They're talking, they're like, oh, I saw that you're going to be growing corn this year. That's so cool. I'd like to grow some corn too. I'm thinking about this or that, or I want to get some peaches and cream, or I want to do that. I will do my damnedest to encourage them to grow what I'm growing. And it's not because I don't want people having the variety, which is spice of life and all that stuff. Variety is the spice of life. We got to enjoy that. It's more that I'm trying to protect my seed crop. And so in an indigenous community where I live, when I explain what my corn is and I show them my corn, they get really excited. They're like, oh my God, that's so cool. Do you have any spare? I don't even have to ask them to grow mine. They always ask me, which is perfect because I would love to give away more seed to them and let them grow their corn. And eventually, like one of my dreams is to see our varieties of corn growing all over my community in almost every household. That would be the dream for me. I would be so elated, so happy if that happened. And it's possible. It's totally possible. I just got to encourage people to grow what I grow and show them why and show them how beautiful it is and tell them why it's so useful. So that's one example. Now, in a small garden in your backyard, especially if you live in a suburban area or even an urban area, it's really difficult to control what your neighbors are growing. Like if you're growing a specific strain of tomatoes and your neighbors are growing a different strain of tomatoes, you're going to have, you know, overlapping cross-pollination. It's going to happen. You can't really stop it. So what you can do to prevent it, or at least increase the odds of you not getting cross-pollination, is you can use blossom bags. Some people call them pollination barriers, all that kind of stuff. Basically, what you're going to do is you're going to wait until those blossoms start to form, and then you're going to put a mesh, almost like cheesecloth bag, over those blossoms before they fully form, and they're just starting to bud. And you're just going to tie it down snugly, not tight enough to damage them, and make sure that they don't get any nutrients flow and water flow. And then as they open up and blossom, the pollen's going to get caught inside the bag. And then you can dip a Q-tip into those bags and self-pollinate the plants yourself. It's getting away from the beauty of having pollinators like bees and butterflies and hummingbirds and everything else. I get that. Trust me, I believe you on that, and I agree with you on that. But if you're trying to preserve a specific strain of a specific species, that's the lengths you've got to go. Either completely isolate it or put up some sort of a blossom bag or blossom barrier, pollination barrier, to keep those bees and other pollinators from cross-pollinating, because that's what they're going to do. They're naturally inclined to pollinate every flower they can to get the nectar. So it's not like you're going to get a risk of having cucumbers in with your tomatoes. You're going to get a cucatomato or something like that. Tomato cucumber or whatever you want to call it. It's not going to happen. They're not related. But if you have a lot of squash and you have a lot of, let's say, watermelons or a lot of other relatives of the squash, you're going to have cross-pollination. You can get what's called mushmelons. So you got to take, especially if you have like summer squash and winter squash growing in your garden, you're going to get mushmelon, which is going to be a very weird, it's not, you know, as thin-skinned as a summer zucchini, but it's not as durable as a acorn squash. You know, that's that mushmelon kind of environment. And that's one of those common cross-pollinations that happens in a garden, is zucchinis or cucumbers with your squashes, with your winter squashes. And so learn to control those pollinations whenever possible, is your best friend when it comes down to seed saving and preserving a specific lineage of that crop, of that plant. So for me, if I'm growing large volume in a small area like corn, I'm going to specifically grow one species or one strain or one cultivar of that corn in that garden. I'm not going to have, you know, popcorn and flint corn and flower corn all in my garden. It's not going to work out to anyone's favor to do that. But secondly, I'm going to make sure that I can isolate it even more by making sure any neighbor that grows corn is growing my variety. And that's not for you could look at it as me being like manipulative or trying to control people. That's not what I'm doing. I'm trying to protect that strain of corn. And once it's been explained to people, 99% of the time they get on board. They want to grow the same thing as well because they want to help out the strain or the cultivar. Beyond that, you can't really control cross-pollination. It's beyond those little things of isolating and barriers. You can't do much more else. So look into plants that you want to grow that are fine with being. You could always look into plants that are a little bit more open to being cross-pollinated or don't have as much risk of cross-pollinating. So some people I know just won't grow corn, and they just won't grow tomatoes, and they just won't grow peppers. They're going to grow things like calendula, nasturtium, all these flowers that most neighbors probably have some already, so it's not a big deal they cross-pollinate, and they're mostly going after the blossoms themselves. But then, of course, you got your squashes, your cucumbers, your zucchinis. And again, talk to your neighbors. Find out what they're growing. All my neighbors in my community who live within a kilometer of me, they know exactly what I'm growing, and I know exactly what they're growing. And that can actually benefit us, because what I can do is I'll grow the corn, the beans, the squash, and the sunflowers, and somebody else will grow the zucchinis, the cucumbers, the melons, and all those. And then somebody else will grow the potatoes and the sweet potatoes and all that. And then we exchange in the harvest season. We trade. Here's a bunch of squash. Oh, thanks for the zucchini. Here's a bunch of corn. Thanks for the sweet potatoes. And we can do that. We can barter in that sense. And that, to me, is a really beautiful way of sharing the food, but also not putting yourself to the point that you have to take care of every single variety of plant. Like what we're doing in my backyard here where I live at what we sometimes nickname the Canadian Bushcraft Compound, jokingly, because we don't really have a bunker or any turret guns yet. One day, dream big, dream big. We're building a food forest behind my house. We have the duck coop, and there's some ducks in there that are eating up bugs. And come spring, we're going to be expanding their pens so they can actually go through the whole garden, be kind of our pest control. And then we have multiple mounds. Many of them are just earthen mounds mixed with a good amount of compost. Some of them are mixed with biochar. Some of them are just mixed with a grow veg mushroom-based compost. Others are Hugel mound or Hugel culture mounds, which I grow my tobacco in, and I grow a few squash varieties in. And then we have the actual true food forest where we have blueberries, currants of like three or four different varieties of currants, all different kinds so they don't easily cross-pollinate. We have red currants and black currants, then another variety of currants gooseberry currants. And they don't cross-pollinate. These are wild currants that grow amongst each other, and they commingle very well without cross-pollinating. And then we have things like black elderberry, red elderberry. We have four or five different varieties of apple trees growing in my backyard. And we're going to be growing even more of those. We've got Saskatoons. We've got service berries. We've got all these different kinds of shrubs back there. And so what I'll do with them, this is the first year that we grew them. We didn't have any fruits on them. We're going to be doing a heavy overhaul of mulching this spring, early spring, like in about a month or so in March, early April. We're going to be wood chipping a ton of buckthorn and locust and a bunch of other trees that we had to clear out of that area of the garden. We're going to mulch them all, lay them down, and that's going to help the trees and the shrubs do really well because they need that mulch to help protect their roots and to help them hold water and to help them transition nutrients. And of course, build up the mycelium, which mycelium helps trees, all that kind of stuff. But when they do fruit, I'll be able to take those really good sized fruits and harvest the seeds from them, just like all my other crops. So I'm going to take, our corn, and I'm going to look at the biggest kernels and the biggest corn stalks that are doing the best. And I'm going to harvest those. I'm going to dry those at the end of the season, harden them up and dry them, and save those for seed growing. And then I'm going to do the same thing with my fruiting bodies, whether it's tomatoes, squash, beans, and of course my actual fruiting trees, like the blueberries, the currants, the apples, and so forth. I'm going to harvest their fruits, and I'm going to harvest their seeds. And those seeds, again, we're going to choose the best of the best, and we're going to plant those next year. And we may plant them in the spring. We may plant them in the fall, depending on what time those seeds need to be planted. But others will simply be labeled and packaged so that I can give them to friends. And I will do seed exchanges with other people. And that's kind of the real fun part of garden work, is that midwinter. Sadly, we didn't do it this year because of COVID-19. But usually we get together with a lot of different people and we do seed exchanges, where we all bring in, it's almost like when I was a kid with Pokemon cards and Magic the Gathering cards. I'm a nerd, if you haven't figured that out yet. This is like our 54th or 55th episode. And if you haven't figured that I'm a nerd yet, man, you got a lot of figuring out to do in the world. But anyways, we would swap seeds just like we used to swap cards as kids. We would swap out corn seeds for corn seeds, and we would swap out beans for beans, and even more so. People would be like, hey, I heard you got this kind of squash, but I don't have any squash. I'd really like to grow that kind of squash. Well, what do you got? Oh, I got popcorn seeds. Cool. And we'll trade for those. And so that's one way of getting into seed starting and seed saving. And of course, growing your garden for next year is to access these seed sources. There's a lot to be said about gardening. And seed saving is one of the kind of like the outer edges of gardening. Everybody thinks about the fertilizing, watering, the soil content, and the growing the crop, and that's about it. And some people think about the preserving, because we talked about preserving food in a previous episode of dehydrating and oiling and all those different methods of preserving the food. But very few people think about, like, what do we do next? And seed saving, it really is, at the end of the day, saving, harvesting, removing, cleaning and preserving those seeds so that you can grow them either yourself the next year or give them to friends to expand the gardens and expand the virility of that strain or that cultivar and get them much more spread out and become more voluminous. There is, like, Seneca Pink Lady Flint Corn is one of the most endangered varieties of indigenous corn varieties or corn cultivars in Ontario. There's like three or four people growing it in all of Ontario, if not like maybe another five or 10 more in the United States, like New York State. but I don't know how many other people are growing Seneca Pink Lady Flint corn, which is a big deal. And so the more people are growing it, the more likely it'll preserve. It'll be revitalized and it'll spread and more people will have access to it so that the Seneca Nation will have their corn still 50 to 100 years from now. That's kind of part of this whole seed saving. You don't save the seeds of, you know, Monsanto varieties because you know that they're not going to be viable for the most part. And you might get some from your tractor supply company, your PVs or whatnot, or your farm supply, and you might find some heirloom strains there. But that doesn't mean that that's necessarily a strain that is, you know, it might be heirloom, but it may not be an endangered variety. And I'm not saying that you have, like, if you're not doing endangered seed saving, you're a monster. That's not the point at all. What I'm trying to get at is it could be another step in your fascination with gardens and growing food of saying, okay, I can preserve and revitalize this cultivar and protect it from going extinct. That's freaking cool. That's freaking cool. I don't care who you are. I don't care how nerdy that makes me sound. That is freaking cool. That you can find a specific strain or cultivar of a crop and it's on the verge of extinction and you can help bring it back from that edge. If we could do that with every animal and plant on the planet, I would be elated. I would be so damned happy. But let's start with these traditional foods since we know we can do that. You know you can grow those plants. And it may say, take some time. As I said at the beginning, like the first couple years of me growing my Bear Island calico Flint corn, it wasn't doing that great. But by year three and year four, it's now putting out 15, 17 foot tall stalks. And the cobs are coming out to about the length of my hand, from the base of my hand to the tip of my middle finger. And I'm hoping, you know, in the next 4 to 5 years, the cobs might start getting from elbow to wrist thick, or not thick, elbow to wrist long, and start producing larger and larger kernels. And who knows, down the road, I might have one of the best stands of calico Flint corn to make my corn soup out of for the rest of my life and for my grandkids and my great-grandkids and all my nieces and nephews and beyond. And they could be growing that variety. And maybe, you know, hey, maybe it changes a little bit because it's adapted to my environment. And maybe I seed saved a little bit more selectively than I should have. And maybe I was keeping only the dark seeds from that calico Flint and eventually starts turning into a mono purpley blue corn. Well, it's still from the calico Flint corn, so it never went extinct. But maybe it's something new. And maybe I caused that myself. And maybe by the second generation, by the generation of my nieces and nephews or my son picking up corn and growing that corn, maybe it's now the muskrat Flint corn or the Musgrave Flint corn or the Hiawatha Flint corn, whatever you want to call it. That's kind of cool in its own right, that it changed it in its own way because nothing is stagnant. Plants change, humans change, animals change over time. And you can see that very quickly with cultivars as you breed them and selectively pollinate and save the seeds and keep growing that specific strain or cultivar. And eventually you just produce a new variety. It happens. And I'm kind of excited about that, even though I will constantly be growing as many colors of that calico Flint corn as I can. I always try to mix up the bag as much as possible before I plant. I don't want to make it too mono purple or mono white or mono red. So it's kind of cool, though, when you sometimes pull out an entire cob and the whole thing is just bluish purple, and yet it was surrounded by reds and calicos and all that stuff around it. You can kind of be like, okay, where'd you get your pollen from? Which ones pollinated you? And you can start to kind of track it through the garden. It's kind of a cool little experience. But yeah, that's what I really want to get down to is the last part of seed saving, which is the real nitty-gritty of how do we do it. So as we said, we're going to take the best seeds from the best fruits from the best plants in the garden. Those are the ones we're going to select. And that can come from a lot of different varieties. Let's say we're looking for something that is more drought tolerant. Well, the ones that did best with the least watering, that's the seeds you want to take from. If I wanted it to be taller, I'm going to go for the tallest stalks only. If I'm looking for one that has longer cobs that are more full, again, I'm going to choose those cobs and take the seeds specifically from those ones. When it comes down to tomatoes or it comes down to peppers, the same thing. Whatever attribute you're looking for, that's what you select for. This is just like selectively breeding animals It's not very much different from that. You just got to control the seed harvest and then make sure that that seed is the one that goes in the ground next year. And then again, select it once more and be mindful every year and observe it every single year. Take notes, write a lot of journals, note all your observations and note also your water content. And like how much have you watered? How much rain has there been? Note the humidex, note the temperatures, note the sun exposures, all that kind of stuff. And once it comes to harvest time, that's when we got to be careful. So for blueberries and other soft fruits that have a large amount of seed inside of them, so tomatoes also can be in that category because tomatoes are a berry. Just remind yourself, tomatoes are a berry. They are a fruit. You can blend it. Just blend it. Get the best ones you have, like the biggest fruits from your blueberries, or the biggest tomatoes you got, or whatever attribute you're going for. Put those into a blender with preferably a soft blade, not a metal blade, and just puree it. And then you're going to put it into a very fine mesh sieve and run it under a tap. And you're going to try and push out all the pulp and keep just the seeds very, very carefully. Then lay those out on a piece of cardboard or I like to use like an old pizza box or an old piece of open, like the very soft cardboard. Spread it out on there, that paste, and leave it in the sun or put it in a dehydrator at the seed drying setting, not at a cooking setting. Don't ever put it in the oven. You don't want to sterilize all the seeds. You're going to just leave it out in the sun or leave it in the dehydrator until it's perfectly dry. And then you can tear that up or scrape off all the seeds into a baggie, into a packet, whatever you got. Label it, date it, mention exactly what strain it is or what cultivar it is and what time of year you harvested and all that kind of stuff. And then next year, grow it again. And that's really all you got to get to. That's really all you got to do. With corn, it's basically an other seed, like cereal grains and pseudo cereal grains, like again, amaranth and wasantle and lamb's quarters. It's simply dry it and then shell it. Not shell it. But basically knock the kernels off the cob carefully so you don't break the germ or anything like that. And you're just going to twist them off the cob and knock them off. If it's wasantle and other pseudo cereal grains, you're going to rub it between your hands and let all those seeds fall into the bag or into the container. And that's the easiest way to harvest, just as it is, just like that. And then just preserve it. Just dry it, make sure it's thoroughly dried, and keep them in watertight containers so that they don't mold. You don't want any kind of mold development in these seeds. I will dehydrate them as much as possible. And then I will put them on into a plastic baggie or into a vacuum bag, preferably with a piece of paper towel, dry, clean paper towel. And then I will vacuum seal it shut with all the seeds inside. And that way the paper towel will suck up any extra moisture. You can also throw in those little like silica packets if you really want to make sure it's completely dry in there. I find that those actually dry it out too much and the seeds often don't germinate too well. I want them to be slightly living inside there because they're just dormant. And this can be a lot of different things. This is just one variety. This is talking about the fruiting seeds. This is not even talking about like seed potatoes and seed sweet potatoes and stuff and garlic and everything else. Those, you pick the biggest ones and you just don't eat them. Store them so they'll last the entire winter. Put them back in the ground the next year. That's what you're going to make your seed out of. Same with my horseradish. I have a lot of my followers know about Charlie the horseradish. And he was my very first horseradish. We're hoping to actually pick up a few more this year to actually be able to propagate and get seed from them this year. But one simple way is to simply remove everything from the core except for the core and put that back in the earth. And that's all you got to do is harvest all the roots, rootlets, all the smaller roots, leave the core root alone with the crown on it, put that back in the earth and come back for it next year or go back to growing it the next year. Currently, Charlie is in a vacuum bag full of dirt in my fridge to keep him from germinating too soon or getting damaged from the frost because he was a southern maritime horseradish. And therefore, I don't believe he was going to do well in our negative 30 conditions that we have here in central Ontario. So next year, I'm going to start hardening them up and I'm going to have a variety of them growing to see if I can get them a little bit more viable in our soils. So I can just leave them in their pots outside. Same thing with my tobacco. I choose my tobacco plants that are producing the best leaves and have the best flavors and all that kind of stuff. and I note their seeds. And then I save their seeds and I regrow them the next year. Very, very straightforward. Now, what if you're just getting into this now? What if this is your first time ever building a garden and you're planning to grow your crops and you want them to be heirloom varieties or heirloom cultivars? Where can we get this stuff? Where can we start? You already know how to build a garden. You already know all the other things about fertilizing and watering the garden and all that kind of stuff. But where do we get the good heirloom seeds? In Eastern Canada, there's two really good stores for heirloom seeds. Richter's, which is here in Ontario, and Vasey's, which is in the Maritimes. I've bought from both, and they're both great. They were great to work with, to deal with, to order from, and they were great delivering their products. The one thing I will recommend is if you're potentially growing shrubs from them, you may want to pick them up in store. I have not had much luck on those shrubs arriving in a good state. And I had one survive for about a month and then it just died because it just was so dehydrated on the journey here. It took a month extra for that shrub to arrive that it just was so dried out that by the time we got it into any water and started to hydrate it, it was a Saskatoon. It just didn't survive. It didn't prosper and it just died. And I was really heartbroken. I was really bummed out because I was out some money, but B, I really love Saskatoons. So instead I went to a local garden center that had heirloom varieties of Saskatoons, and I got those and I planted them and I'm much happier with them. I was sad for the one that I got, but the ones that I got in store were much better. So I would recommend if you can go to Richter's, if you're in Eastern Canada, if you're in Ontario, go to Richter's and pick up. If they're allowing pickup, in-store pickups, do that. When it comes down to internationally or elsewhere out of Canada, there's places like Seeds Now, Trade Winds Fruit, Baker Creek, and of course the Seed Savers Exchange, which is a nonprofit organization that doesn't sell seed. They help you organize to exchange seeds, and they help you find seeds that are viable for your area and grow those crops where you are. They are not necessarily a store. They're not a business. They want to build a movement, not a business, is what one of their mission statements is about them, which I find really cool. Those are great options. And of course, if you're an Indigenous person, contact local First Nation communities to see who has access to seed saving for your Indigenous foods. Look into those things. And if you're non-Indigenous, you could probably partner up. There's projects like the Flint Corn Project here in Ontario and probably down in the United States because it's through Dynanega and Akwesasne. The Flint Corn Project is trying to preserve traditional Ganyageha or Haudenosaunee strains or cultivars of corn, of Flint corn, which is really cool. And of course, there's many other places you can look to help support these things, support these projects. So definitely look into all those options and do your research. If you live in Australia, I can't help you. I can't tell you where to get your seeds. I can't tell you what's a good store for Australians. But for people who live here in Canada, in Ontario especially, contact us at CanadianBushcraftPodcast@gmail.com and ask your questions there. And we'll do our best to help you find sources for your seeds. I do recommend Vasey's and Richter's, though. They are two of my favorite stores. So yeah, that's about all we have to say about this. This is our patrons selected special. This is the patrons only special, or not the patrons only, but the patrons special where they chose this episode. They chose the ones that this episode out of a couple of options, they voted on this one. So I want to thank people like John Milligan, John Milligan, Davis, Quigley, Monica, Ben, Riley, Sherry Ann from Blue Jay Botanicals, Katie Harper, all these amazing people, Miriam Lyle, who are our patrons, our supporters at Patreon, who keep the lights on here, who keep Sushi fed so she doesn't try to turn me into sushi, who help us support by keeping the lights on, the electricity on, and of course paying the bills so we can create this podcast. This amazing little portable one microphone sound booth that we have built around the microphone and the headphones that I'm wearing right now. This all came from Patreon to help make sure that we can make the best quality podcast we can for you. And in exchange, we give you back the best quality stuff we can and give you a chance to have a say on this. Every single one of our patrons, whether they're a $1 tier, a $50 tier or whatever other tiers we have. I actually haven't looked at the tiers lately. I got to look at those tiers very soon. Whatever tier they're at, everyone has their say on what comes up on the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast. They can contribute by simply asking for an episode, and we will see where we can fit it into the schedule. Or every month we do patrons' choice, where they have a bunch of choices given to them, and they vote on the one that they want on the podcast. And this is one of those episodes. This was the episode for February, where they chose this, the All About Seed Saving. So hopefully it's a shorter episode than what we are you're probably used to with us lately. We've been doing like 2 hour, 3 hour podcasts over the longer parts of the winter. But now that we're getting into the shorter parts of the winter and it's getting more and more daylight, our episodes are starting to wane as well. They're starting to become much shorter. Hopefully not too short. We want to make sure we're giving you as much quality as we can. But anyways, thank you to everybody at Patreon. Thank you to all of our supporters there. Of course, thanks to Chris Outdoors, Chris Gilmore from Chris Outdoors with Nature's Forgotten Language, who is dropping some amazing information on that online course. It is absolutely amazing. Check it out. You can sign up right now today if you want, and you can use Dragonfly as your passcode to get on there and get a discount on the course. Check it out, folks. Anyways, save your seeds. We'll see you next growing season.